And you ran High Top Records as a professional business with students, correct?
No, it was actually a junior achievement company. Gaiety Records was a sponsor, just like Honeywell sponsored some of the companies, General Mills sponsored some of the companies. The companies themselves were all students, and they had like a vice president, a president, all that. And myself and two other people were advisors. So it really wasn't, it was a student-run company. It was not meant to be a profitable, profit-making thing. It just happened to turn out that way.
It was a way for students to learn about business.
Exactly.
Okay. And your business became extremely successful.
Right.
Which for some reason didn't go over well with junior achievement.
Correct.
So that lasted roughly how long?
A year.
High Top, you told me at one point, was one of the highest grossing junior achievement companies in the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay, so after the location at Empire Photosound, did the studio location move again?
Yes, we then moved to the Calhoun Beach Club, and we took over the WTCN radio, had a studio there, and they moved. So I was able to utilize that and then use their main ballroom as the studio part of the recording.
What time period was that?
1963.
And how long did you stay at the Calhoun Beach Club?
I think for about a year.
So after your location at the Calhoun Beach Club in Minneapolis, where did the studio move to next?
We moved to the Builders Exchange Building because WDGY had their main studios there, and the era when Top 40 was very, very popular, and they moved their studio to 106th Street, which is in Bloomington.
Is it here where you do a lot of the folk bands?
Yes. I recorded the Flint Hill Singers there and the Goldbriars.
What do you recall about the Flint Hills? Where were they from?
The Flint Hill Singers were from Washburn High School in Minneapolis. They were kind of a carbon copy of the New Christy Minstrels, which were very popular then. And they originally started with an ensemble of about 12 girls and guys in there, and then they eventually went down to about six.
How many songs did you record with the Flint Hill Singers?
At least 24.
More than an album's worth.
Oh, yes.
And did you try to get a record deal for them?
Yes, I tried to get a record deal with them, and because they're so much like the New Christy Minstrels, there was no interest. And their main singer was a gentleman named John Wadeen, who was 17 and just had a fantastic voice.
And I know another folk band you recorded was called the Levy Loungers.
They were not a folk band. They were kind of a Dixieland band. And we recorded them at Harriet Island, which is, now it's called Harriet Island, but I forgot what it was called back then. And I had licensed their music to Audio Fidelity. Audio Fidelity was a very audiophile label. They were the ones that first released the stereo disc in 1957. And Audio Fidelity was run by a gentleman named Sid Fry, who also had the Dukes of Dixieland, Johnny Paleo, and a number of other people under contract.
Where was Audio Fidelity located?
They were in New York-based.
And what do you recall about, what can you tell us about the Goldbriars?
The Goldbriars were also from Washburn High School, and they had come into the studio, and we recorded them. They had a very, very unique sound, and I had licensed them to Epic Records, which was a division of Columbia Records.
Who was in the band?
Dottie and Cherry Holmberg were sisters. They were the singers. Kurt Betcher is the one that did all the arrangements and played guitar and did vocals, and Ron Nielsen on lead guitar. Interesting, Kurt Betcher went on to be a very big producer in California. He worked with the association, and I think he worked with some of the Beach Boys and did a number of, he became very, very big out there.
Did the Goldbriars have any success on Epic Records?
Yes, they were quite popular. They were on Hootenanny and some of the TV shows, and they had a very, very unique sound.
Different than a typical folk band?
Yes.
So there was a whole era here in Minneapolis of folk bands.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of coffee houses, too. I mean, one of the places very popular in Dinkytown, which is at the University of Minnesota, was the Scholar, which was owned by a gentleman named Connie Hector. And Connie Hector had a newsletter out and so forth. And there were coffee houses at that point were very popular. And that's where these folk bands played.
David, there is a number of different record labels that apparently are related to Gaty but have different names. One of them is Perry Records. What do you know about that?
Perry Records was started by a gentleman named Bob Weiss, who owned a bakery in St. Paul and was also a songwriter, and also Bill Cermak, who worked at United Hardware Distributing Company, where I worked as a keyliner. And Bill was the controller there and also a songwriter. And both of them knew I had a recording studio and they wanted to start a record label. So that's how Perry was born. And what they wanted to do is, for some reason, all the recordings for Perry were done at K-Bank.
Apparently there were three 45s on the Perry label. Do you recall the artists?
Right. The Glen Rays, Lanny Minns, and Wayne Terso.
And the other label that appears to have some association with Gaty is Laura Records, which had the big M's out.
Right. Laura Records was a private label by the big M's, and the main person there was a gentleman named Walker Munson. They were all from North High School, and at that point, if Motown was popular, they would have been a great band to license to Motown because their music was rhythm and blues.
That was a very early band in the Twin Cities,
yes,
correct?
They were quite good.
Speaking of R&B bands, there were two groups that recorded for Gaty that were in the R&B style, the Valquins and the Wisdoms. What can you tell us about them?
Both of them were from St. Paul Central High School, and they were terrific bands. They wrote their own music and so forth. Neither band played their own instruments, so I had the Glen Rays back up the Valquins, and also the Glen Rays backed up the Wisdoms, but for some reason the Wisdoms weren't happy with the Glen Rays, so they went switched to the Flames. And the songs the Valquins did was My Dear and Falling Star. The Wisdoms did Two Hearts Make One Love and Lost in Dreams. And if you check eBay, once in a while you'll see the recordings on there, and either one of the originals go for quite a few dollars.
And I believe I saw one, speaking of eBay, that was actually a reproduction of, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was the Valquins or the Wisdoms, on red vinyl.
There seems to be a lot of reproductions on a lot of my recordings. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that the Sonics and the Blue Cats have been mm-hmm. reproduced, and I think you're right about the Wisdoms and the Valquins.
I guess it's sort of a tribute in a way, but do you look at it as a tribute or not?
No.
You'd rather have authorized releases.
Right.
Also, I do want to mention the country artist that you had in 59 and 1960, did a couple 45s, and that was Chuck Carson, right?
Right. I did some recordings for Chuck Carson, and I also did some recordings, and we never pressed any records. I did some work with Dave Dudley also.
Dave Dudley of 6 Days on the
yes,
Road fame.
Yes, Dave Dudley.
A very popular country singer in the early 60s. And another band from out of town that you had was Tommy Lee and the Orbits, who did a couple Christmas songs apparently in the late portion of 1960.
Right. They recorded Jingle Rock and Rudolph Cha-Cha, which was kind of a takeoff on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Kind of a novelty song.
Right, exactly.
And they were from, I believe they were from Brainerd, Minnesota?
I don't recall.
And now there was another band you recorded, the Del Ricos, had a person in the band who turned out to be a DJ, correct?
Yes, it was Darwin Eckholm was a member of the Del Ricos, and he got a job at WDGY at their new studios in Bloomington, and he was a disc jay, Donald K. Martin.
Did Donald play any of your 45s?
No, because he had become a DJ far after the Del Rico period.
And there's a young lady, sounds like it, Diane Edmond, who recorded kind of a novelty song in 1962. Do you recall her?
Right. I forgot how old she was, but she recorded Potato Twist and Go On and Cry. She was kind of like a Connie Francis.
And then I believe your final 45 on Gaty was by the local band The Jades. They did Blue Black Hair and Surfing Crow. Do you recall that group?
Honestly, I don't recall the group. or the song.
But that does turn out to be the final 45 released on Gaiety.
Yes.
So Gaiety Records comes to an end about 64, and what do you do next, David?
I get a job as a keyliner with Viking Press, since I had quite a bit of graphic experience with United Hardware Distributing in their advertising department. And at that point in 1963, I was married, so I figured it was time to get a full-time employment.
Just out of curiosity, what is a keyliner?
Keyliner at that point in time is you would take type or pictures and paste it on a piece of paper, and that would be your page layout, and then you would take a picture of it on film and then make a printing plate out of it. Now everything is done on the computer in PageMaker or Publisher or one of the software programs available.
And while you're at Viking Press in Bloomington, you're still in the record business doing record jackets, right?
Right. We're doing record jackets. And I think the first one we did with Viking Press was a polka band called the Jolly Brothers.
And you're doing mostly jackets for recordings coming out of K-Bank at this time?
Right. We were working very closely with K-Bank, and we were doing jackets for them. We were printing them, and then the assembly of the jackets at that point in time was done by a company in Chicago called Chicago Album.
And how long do you stay with Viking Press?
I was with them for about 2 years.
And your next move is to what company?
Go to a company called RB Graphics, which is a hop skip from Viking Press, and they were a supplier to Viking. What I did with them was more in the sales area, because they saw the opportunity with the record business to continue in the record jacket business as a full-time venture.
And your next move is to where?
Well, the building that RB Graphics was in had an open space in the front area, so we went to Money Tree, which was the fundraising arm of Pearson Candy Company, which made those mint patties and 7-Up bars and so forth, and nut goodies. We formed a company called Melody Masters and basically continued to make record jackets there. And at that time, I had moved my cutting lathe there so I could still do mastering.
That's your Neumann lathe?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and what happens to Melody Masters?
Melody Masters then evolves into a company called Music Masters, which was basically a name change.
Where were they located? In Bloomington?
Yes, in Bloomington.
Is that by the 94th and James
Yes,
complex?
That's exactly. In fact, we were right next door to the main office of B. Dalton Booksellers.
Mm-hmm. And what does Music Masters do?
We do the same thing. We're basically doing record jackets and doing mastering. And we're thinking about building a recording studio.
Was that your idea?
Myself and a couple of the other people involved in it.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to your idea of building a recording studio?
Well, we actually built the studio, and then at that point in time, the music industry was starting to change very drastically, and we just didn't see where this would become very profitable to be doing bands and so forth.
So what happens?
We were offered a chance to sell the studio and all the equipment other than the lathe to Dove Recording, which I'm not sure moved from another location or they had just started.
Mm-hmm. And who was at Dove at that point?
Daryl Iverson was the main lead at Dove Studios.
So at that point in the mid-60s, your time in the music industry comes to an end, is that correct?
Yes.
And at any other time period, did you jump back in, or?
Well, in 1980, I got involved again with a company similar to Junior Achievements, which was a DECA company, DECA. It was a bunch of students and so forth, and we've called the company Sound Investments, and did records, and one of the things we did was a group from Robbinsdale, 45, with the Surgeons, and they sold that at local places and so forth, but that's as far as that went.
And in 1994, there were two CDs released of Gaiety recordings between 1958 and 1964. Were you aware of these two CDs that were out?
No, I was not.
When did you become aware of the two Gaiety CDs?
about 2 or 3 years after the fact, and I'm not sure how I heard about them, if somebody told me or I saw an ad or something, but I was just amazed.
So originally it was not an authorized release.
No, and especially when I saw that my picture was in there and so forth, I was just floored.
So what did you do?
I contacted the company that had released it, and they were a little surprised to hear from me. And I just said, you know, how can you be doing this? My picture, my label, everything. Mm-hmm. So they mentioned that they had rights and this and that. But anyway, they were very nice people, and we worked it out, and everybody's happy.
So at this point in time, it is an authorized release.
Yes, it is.
Was there a certain time period where you started realizing there was a renewed interest in the Gaiety 45s?
Well, when I look at eBay and stuff, and I see my stuff on there, and I see these ridiculous amounts. In fact, I think Suga had told us that one of my Gaiety records had sold for, what, $4,000?
Suga Records?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was that a surprise to you to find out that record collectors across the world were paying large amounts of money for the Gaiety 45s?
Well, yes and no. I mean, that amount, yes. But I know that the Wisdoms and the Valquins, some of those had got well over $1,000 on eBay.
Do you have a favorite Gaiety 45?
I actually like the R&B stuff. I like the Wisdoms, I like the Valquins, and I like the Big M's. I mean, I always liked the Motown music when that became very popular. And I like the folk music.
And give us an update as to what you're doing now.
Now I'm doing some consulting. I'm doing trying some things in the music business with a couple of partners. Other than that, not much. You know, I still keep my eye on it a little bit. But the music business has changed so drastically. There really isn't a music business anymore. I mean, CDs are going by the wayside. DVDs are going by the wayside. People are streaming movies, downloading songs. The quality of recordings nowadays, when you're doing MP3s and listening to them on iPads and things like that, you're really not getting the phone quality. But the younger generation just doesn't seem to care for quality. There does not seem to be a big interest in high quality, good, full audio file recordings anymore.
And yet, when we took that recent trip to Suga Records and talked to the owner, Adam Rosen, he informed us there was a renewed interest in vinyl records.
Right. Vinyl is becoming very popular, and that's part of it is that people feel that the sound of vinyl is better than the sound on digital CDs. I can't say one way or the other, but vinyl is becoming very, very popular. I mean, it's changed a lot, and a lot of the pressings are done overseas. In fact, a good friend of mine that has a recording studio in the UK is setting up a pressing plant over there.
When you look back at your time with Gaiety Records, what are your feelings about being involved with the recording business at such a young age?
At that point in time, it was a very fun business. I enjoyed it. Got to meet a lot of people. And it was, when I say it was a fun business, it was a lot different than like what it is now. I mean, you had actual record companies that you could do work for. You could license music. It was fun.
David, thank you for taking the time to share your memories today of Gaiety Records and your involvement in the recording business.
You're welcome.
The preceding interview was recorded on January 21st, 2012, at Danger Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and was engineered by Dave Erbely and produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell.
Hey, baby, you over there? Yeah, the one with the blue-black hair. Well, blue-black hair, shaded eyes. Baby, you've got me hypnotized. You're the girl with the long, long blue-black hair. Say, little girl, you're so fine. Well, you just got to be mine. Well, blue-black hair, shaded eyes, baby, you've got me hypnotized. You're the girl with the long, long blue-black hair. Well, I don't know what's your name, but your blue-black hair drives me insane. Blue-black hair, shady-eyed eyes, baby, you've got me hypnotized. Blue-black hair, blue-black hair, blue-black hair, blue-black hair, blue-black hair.